Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us on this lovely, crisp Melbourne evening. My name is Alex Oliver. I am with the Lowy Institute. I direct the Lowy Institute's polling program, and I have conducted the last four of the Lowy Institute's annual opinion polls. And I've been with the Institute for about 9 years now, working on various other projects as well, including Australia's diplomatic infrastructure. Joining me today are three extremely distinguished panellists. They're both clever and fun, as you can see by the colours, and I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're seated. Jim, on my left. Jim Middleton is one of Australia's most senior and distinguished political and international journalists. For two decades, he was ABC political editor in Canberra, covering Prime Ministers Hawke, Keating and Howard. At the height of the Reagan era, he was a foreign correspondent in New York and Washington. He was present at President Reagan's first two summits with Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev, saw Alan Bond's Australia to win the America's Cup, and covered the Falklands War from Argentina. He's reported from every country in North, South and Southeast Asia, except North Korea. He's now correspondent at Sky News and a Vice Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Melbourne. Holly Ransom has a fascinating CV and skill set. She is co-chair of the UN's Global Coalition of Young Women Entrepreneurs and recently became the youngest ever female director of an Australian Football League club. With her appointment to the board of Port Adelaide Football Club, she was named one of AFR and Westpac's 100 most influential women in 2002 and was the world's youngest ever Rotary president. In 2014, the Prime Minister, then Tony Abbott, it is hard to keep up, appointed Holly to chair the G20 Youth Summit. Holly is also a CEO of a strategic advisory firm, Emergent. Tim Watts has been Federal Labor member for Gellibrand, is that how you pronounce it? That's right, since 2013. Tim worked in IT and telecoms for over a decade at Telstra and at Mallison Solicitors, my alma mater. He has a Bachelor of Laws, a Master of Public Policy and a Master of Politics and Communication from the prestigious London School of Economics. Already in a very successful career, in 2013, Tim did what most of us lack the courage to do and ran for Federal Parliament. Not content with being a Federal MP, Tim and fellow MP Claire O'Neill co-authored a book last year on the future of Australian politics called Two Futures, Australia at a Critical Moment. It lays down the challenges for today's politicians to overcome short-termism, to focus on policy, not politics, and on substance, not spin, all of which we all wish for. They have very generously given of their time, and I'm going to keep to our timing, which is very strict for the Lowy Institute. I'm going to give a very brief slide presentation just to give you a taste of what was in this year's poll before we then go to a panel discussion for around 20 to 25 minutes, and then we'll go to questions and answers with you. So 2016 marks 12 years of Lowy Institute polling on Australian attitudes to the world. Can you hear? Am I going between microphones? Just let me know. The goals of the poll are twofold. Firstly, to find out what Australians actually think about the world, to get real data on which government can draw in its policy-making process, so evidence-based policy, rather than relying on the opinion of what is in Australia a particularly small foreign policy elite, because in the end, successful foreign policy depends on public support. Our second aim is to engage the Australian public in the debate about Australia's foreign policy. We literally ring them up and ask them what they think. Every year we have a mix of new and previously asked questions. The new questions are to develop an understanding, obviously, of emerging issues, Donald Trump. And our previously asked questions are tracking questions which inform us of trends over time. For example, relationships with major partners or neighbours, China, United States, Indonesia, on issues such as climate change or war in the Middle East. And it's one of the tracking questions that I'm going to take you to first, which is the way Australians feel about the US alliance. Now, you probably won't be able to read the text, but what I hope you can see there are the trends. So that is 12 years of Lowy Institute polling on the way Australians feel about the alliance. Australians have always been highly supportive of our security alliance, and in fact, when you look at the next result, which isn't shown there, which is whether they strongly support the alliance, very important, fairly important, or somewhat important. When you add those all up together, it's never been less than 90% of Australians who think that the alliance is important for Australia's security. But as you can see, there have been some highs and lows, and there is a low this year. This year's poll saw the largest shift in sentiment on the US alliance since 2009. It was down 9 points to 71% who now say the alliance is either very or important or fairly important to Australia's security. That's the lowest level since 2007 during the Bush years, when 63% took this view of the alliance. So as with every public debate this year, it seems the US presidential elections and Donald Trump have infiltrated even the Lowy Institute poll. Not surprisingly, Donald Trump appears to be a factor in this cooling towards the alliance. When asked which candidate they would prefer as President of the United States, 77% of Australians prefer Hillary Clinton and only 11% prefer Donald Trump. While our fieldwork for the main part of the poll was done in February and March of this year, we did an additional telephone poll with a very similar sample size in June once the US presidential candidates had been finalised. So this is quite a recent result. Our polling is a lot further apart than US polling on the two candidates, obviously. An even stronger 84% say that Hillary Clinton would do a better job of handling US foreign policy. The second main observation I found in this year's poll was how uncertain Australians are about China, and there's some really contradictory results here. Firstly, in a question that we asked first in 2014, which relationship is more important to Australia's relationship with the United States or Australia's relationship with China? Exactly the same number of Australians this year say China as say the United States, and that's different from when we first asked it. So the light blue lines there on the top and the second top bars show last 2014 result, and you can see how much that's shifted. When we first asked this in 2014, it was very clearly Australians saw the United States as the most important relationship to Australia. Now there's a complete dead heat. Looking just at Asia, in 2013, some of you may remember that Tony Abbott met Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the sidelines of an important East Asia summit meeting in Brunei, and famously referred to Japan as Australia's best friend in Asia. This language was new. Usually politicians and diplomats use quite careful language, such as Australia has no better friend in Asia. Unsurprisingly, therefore, the comment raised eyebrows in a few places, not least of which was in Beijing. So we thought we'd test out that concept with the Australian public. And we asked them who is Australia's best friend in Asia. 30% this year say China and 25% say Japan, and that's the dark blue lines on the top two rungs there. Last time we asked this question in 2014, it was a dead tie. Looks like there's a slight difference, but it was statistically inseparable. Then a long way down the pecking order came Indonesia at 15% saying this was Australia's best friend, Singapore and India. But despite China being seen as our best friend in Asia, Australians have strong reservations about China's intentions. And I'm really not sure you'll be able to see but on the right-hand side are our positive feelings towards China, and on the left-hand side, the orange bars, are our negative feelings about China. 8 in 10 Australians say China's military activities in our region are a negative influence on their view of China. Nearly 9 in 10 take a dim view of China's human rights record. Nearly 3/4 are wary of its system of government. And majorities see Chinese investment and its environmental record as a negative. Thirdly, this is my final observation, is about Australian what's important to Australia. And we thought in the lead up to this year's election we should ask Australians actually what are the important issues for them, whether that's domestic or foreign policy issues. And I was interested in finding out exactly where foreign policy issues rank in the hierarchy. Where do they come? Is terrorism really Australia's primary concern? As it turns out, no. Education, health and domestic violence, interestingly, are the highest in importance issues for Australians. In a signal which the government should perhaps have heeded in the election campaign, the economy is not the highest priority issue either. It comes fourth after education, health and domestic violence. But interestingly, and this is one that I'll put to Tim in our panel discussion, dysfunction in Australian politics scores similarly to terrorism and national security in importance to Australians. And this will lead me to my final chart, which is probably the most controversial result we've had in our history, our 12-year history of polling. It's the result that's caused the most debate and controversy. 60% of adults in Australia say that democracy is the most preferable form of government, only 60%. But even more worrying is how young Australians feel about democracy, and that is a very, very complicated chart for which I apologise. But the top bar there is how all adults feel about democracy, and the dark blue are those who say that democracy is the most preferable form of government. The other options we give them is it doesn't matter what sort of government we have, or the middle row is a more authoritarian system of government might work better. So they are of considerable concern, but the 18 to 29 year olds are the bottom row, and it has fluctuated from year to year as we've asked this, but it has been as low as 39% of young Australians who say that democracy is the most preferable form of government. Just taking you back to those top 10 important issues, and these are things which I hope that we'll discuss with in our panel discussion, or even perhaps you can raise them in question and answer session. One is the asylum seeker and refugee issue. You can see the ranking of refugees and asylum seekers here as an issue in the Australian political debate, ranks 7th and 8th, immigration ranks 8th. So these are falling quite low on the ranking of Australians' policy priorities. Both of these are obviously now assuming a very high prominence in the public debate with the resurrection of One Nation and Pauline Hanson. So I just thought I'd leave you with that thought as we head into discussion with the people who have come here kindly today. Talk about them. So, Tim, I did promise to talk to you about political dysfunction, and you've written a whole chapter in your book about it. You do say something about political churn, and in your chapter on democracy, you point out that voter disengagement is higher than at any time since the 1920s. So I was wondering if you could perhaps talk about how you react to those results. Do you believe them, for example? What do you think is driving that 60% or 48% of young Australians who say that democracy is the most preferable form of government?
Well, I can tell you anecdotally, as a member of parliament, someone who's interacting with voters on a daily basis, it absolutely rings true. The exasperation that people feel, that Australians feel with not just their government, but their political institutions is extremely visceral at the moment. It's not a intellectual disengagement, it's a really emotional, I feel betrayed, I feel completely isolated from our political institutions. So, you know, I might want to sort of glibly say, oh, we can solve that with a new government, which I certainly believe we can improve something with a new government. This is really a Catholic trend. What we write about, Claire O'Neill and I, in our book, is that the interesting thing about this trend is that it's not limited to Australia. You can look at any Western democracy and find similar statistics of voter disengagement. And you get various explanations for this, but my personal view is that across the Western world, our political institutions, the institutions of our democracy, haven't really adapted in 100 years. If you ask a sociologist what an institution is, they'll say that it's a function of norms and expectations of people and technology, effectively. You think about how norms and expectations of people have changed and how technology have changed in 100 years, and you think about how our parliament has changed. I mean, we still have three readings of a bill in parliament because when that process was initiated, parliamentarians were illiterate. Now, the quality of parliamentarians has advanced since that time.
Maybe not all of them.
Even our new senators can read and write, I can assure you. They might be suspicious of punctuation, but they can read and write. So what I argue in the book is that in the same way that that the business sector has really used technology to respond to increased expectations and demands to provide customized, individualized services to people, like even the banks are providing customized, you know, individualized internet services, apps. You know, they're not on the cutting edge of innovation usually. So should our parliament. So a great example of this is marriage equality. We can't get a bill for marriage equality onto the floor of the parliament for a vote, even though a majority of parliamentarians support it, even though an overwhelming majority of Australians want that change to happen. We have the technological capability now to have a citizen-initiated vote on this bill. I mean, there are parliaments around the world in Western democracies where if you reach a certain threshold of online signatures, so to speak, you can force a debate in the parliament. So we talk about recapturing the spirit of democratic innovation in Australia. We used to be a real groundbreaking world leader in democratic innovation in the late 19th century, early 20th century. We don't claim to have all the answers, but we think we should be experimenting, trying to do new things in order to re-engage the public. Because at the moment, you know, the change machine of Australia, the way that we change public opinion, the way we set a new course as a nation, it's really broken.
Mm. Holly, what about the you know, reaction of the youth to that question, where, you know, why is only one in two, you know, young millennials or Y generation aged Australians having that sort of response, do you think?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting one. And picking up on what Tim said, it's certainly not unique to just what Australia is going through. We're seeing this level of disillusionment, apathy, disaffection across certainly the UK, across the US. It's really interesting tracking the data. The best way that I could put it out there from a perspective of having worked a lot with young people for about 10 years now and a lot in youth policy development is I feel like young Australians believe a social contract got broken with them. And this is particularly around the level of youth unemployment that we have in our community. Back in 2014, when I had the privilege of being appointed to lead the G20 Youth Summit, we went out there and spoke to young people across 20 nations and ran extensive polling through Australia at that point in time around what's the most pressing issue that's impacting on your quality of life, that's impacting on your level of positivity and optimism about the future. And the big issue we came back with was youth unemployment. Alarming levels globally, you know, one in three global young people not in education, training or employment, which is extraordinary when you think about the fact that 50% of the world's population are under the age of 30. So the level of disengagement from our traditional institutions, systems and structures is enormous. And I think often we think that's removed from the Australian context and the Australian backyard, but 30% of young Australians right now are unemployed or underemployed. And the thing that we've got exacerbating that too is looking at if you look at education as the most pressing issue, you know, reports coming out from the Foundation for Young Australians saying, well, in the next decade, 60% of what we're skilling and training our young Australians in will become irrelevant. So it's not just that we're not caught up to the rolling ball, it's that we're continually falling further and further behind where it's heading as well. So I think for a lot of young Australians, they're going, well, hold on a minute, I thought if I went and did my learning, I got to go do my earning. How come to an enormous extent that that's not matching anymore? How come we've got so many young people walking out of their vocational education? Well, actually, don't even get me started on vocational ed, because a lot of them, we actually have the lowest completion rates in the Western world. So there's a huge problem with what we've actually let happen to vocational ed from a tertiary standpoint. Increasingly, and this is anecdotal as well, but I will meet people with master's qualifications and PhDs that are working front counter retail because they can't get employed in what they've got qualified in. You know, I finished in 2013 with a law degree, 900 graduates in my cohort in WA for 200 legal jobs. So we've got this huge disconnect that's going on. And I think that's a big part of where this growing frustration is with leaders, young people feeling like they're not being heard, and perhaps policy settings that increasingly there's not expectations being managed well, but I think also to a large extent in some key pillars like employability, like the ability to provide for oneself, young people feeling like they've been let down by the system. So it doesn't surprise me to see that reaction.
In that age group, we find year after year that they hold quite different views from their elders. So if you look at the under 30s and the over 30s, they hold quite distinct set of views. Not only the question about democracy, but that younger age group are interestingly more optimistic about the economy usually, which sort of goes against what you've observed there. They're less supportive of the US alliance. They don't like US bases in Australia. They're less inclined to spend more on defence. They're more tolerant of boat arrivals, and they're more opposed to offshore processing, just to take a few of the examples. And I have wondered, and I have no way of yet proving, but it'll be a good study to do next year, because that group next year will be 12 years older and they'll have slipped into the next age bracket. So there's some analysis to be done there. But is this group just finding another way to express rebellion, railing against the political structures of the time? Are they, you know, the Churchillian or Clemenceau? I think there's a debate about who actually said this, but if you're not a liberal at 20, you have no heart. If you're not conservative at 40, you have no head. Are these young Australians going to change in their views about not just all of those things, but about democracy as well, when they grow up? Is it something that they become more conservative about? Is this just rebellion, or do you think there actually is something in the system that's broken, Jim?
I think there's a bit of both, to be honest. I think certainly that that long-run trend of from liberalism to conservatism is something that we're seeing here. But I think there's another question which is overlaid, or another point or set of points which is overlaid over that, which is questions about democracy relating to authenticity, effectiveness in particular. And I think that's something newish. If I can take an example that comes not from Australia but from Britain, and I think it was very starkly reflected in the Brexit referendum, where you saw a quite different attitude to the UK leaving the EU among the young as opposed to the old, the better educated as opposed to the less so.
But couldn't get them out to vote.
Yes, but that goes to the point about authenticity and effectiveness, because I think that, I'm not sure whether this is an apocryphal story or one that is actually backed up, but I did see it reported that there was surprise among some young people about the result. They were then asked whether they'd voted no, and at least someone was reported as saying, oh, can't we have an online poll about it and do it all again? Well,
there you go.
Democracy doesn't work like that, but I think that goes to a particular problem. But I also think it relates to notions of sovereignty in the nation state in a globalised world. That is, that what democracies can and cannot do these days is not quite what it was when Churchill stood up against fascism and managed to enlist Roosevelt to the cause in the 1930s and came out victorious. The democracies won. The democracies won the Cold War, but have they been winning since 1989? No, probably not. And there have been significant consequences for that. Overlaid on top of this is the massive and rapid technological change, which I think the permanence of the speed, the velocity of it is so rapid and so fast. My children will work in jobs which, if they have a job, which have not yet been invented. Mm-hmm. And some of the jobs that are being done now that my older children are doing will disappear before they turn 40. And then they'll have to reskill and retrain. And I think this leads to considerable anxiety, which then leads to a degree of alienation. And added to that then is the effectiveness of politicians in dealing with it. And in Australia in recent years, we have seen a lack of effectiveness. We've seen this turbulence, this churning, and that cannot have anything to do in terms of confidence either.
Mm. Speaking of democracy not necessarily winning since 1989, what do you make of this China as Australia's new best friend in Asia, Tim?
I think it's a reflection of the pragmatic way that Australians engage with the rest of the world. I think if you speak to most Australians, what they see when they think of China is the economic opportunity. They see jobs, they see wages, they see the economic future of Australia. The thing that did strike me about the Lowy poll though this year is that I liked how it went into the granularity of, well, what's driving it. And the idea that that one-on-one contacts with Chinese citizens was driving a lot of that affection gave me a lot of faith. As a federal politician, I sort of see every day that a lot of the way that Australia engages with the rest of the world is through our own community. As a very diverse, multicultural country, we are exposed to the world through the diaspora communities in our society. So at the moment, the proportion of the Australian community who is born in China, Australian citizens, is as high as it was in the Gold Rush period. It's about 2% of the Australian population. The Indian-born Australian community is very similar in proportion. And you can see the trade and investment channels that are being driven through those diaspora communities. I mean, we particularly saw it through the Hong Kong Chinese community. But as India begins to open up, I think you'll increasingly see it in India as well. So, I mean, I saw that best friend in Asia statistic and I thought, well, it makes sense because that's where the people-to-people connections really are.
I think there's a very interesting point that you're making there, and if you look at Australia's economic engagement with China and the impact of the generation, the Tiananmen Square generation, that 90,000 or so that came in at that point, disproportionately they are represented in the people who are doing business with China now, to the massive benefit of Australia. And these people basically came in effectively under the radar, as it were. Bob Hawke didn't even take it to the cabinet at the time. It was something with tears rolling down his face he did in the Great Hall of the Great Hall in Canberra. Had Australians, I suspect at the time, been asked whether they wanted all these people to be allowed in, they probably would have said, the majority probably would have said no. But the additional benefit beyond the mining boom to Australia of that as a development is really profound and really significant. Just one other thing I'll say about those findings is yours, the ambivalence that you have here on the one about China, on the one hand, best friend in Asia, etc., etc., but on the South China Sea in particular, there really is considerable concern on foreign investment too. Now the two don't sit together; they're contradictory, as it were. So you have this acknowledgement that we are tied and bound to China, 40% of exports going there. It's obvious that this is a relationship which is highly important to our future prosperity. But there is this ambivalence and concern, and rightfully so, in the case of the South China Sea, not so much in the case of foreign investment. I mean, this is a country which has depended on foreign investment since the first fleet arrived. Had it not been for the British, the Americans, more recently the Japanese, and now the Chinese, we would be a far poorer economy than we are now. Policymakers are not prepared to make that point with sufficient force and rigour, and too many of our leaders over time have been too prepared to go down the cheap route of actually, and it's happening right now. In fact, this is, in my view, it's a disgrace what's happened in terms of Chinese investment and the ceilings that have been placed on it as far as farmland goes. This is very much part of our future. We cannot raise the capital ourselves. It's got to come from overseas. The nationals who complain about poor living standards in the country at the same time as refuse the obvious sources of foreign investment, which will very much improve the prosperity of the communities in which they live, is a nonsensical way to approach this particular issue. So I just think that those. You know, I can understand the anxiety to a degree; it's justified. But on the other hand, I think it's interesting to see this fundamental recognition within the Australian community of the value and importance of the Chinese relationship.
Well, you raise an interesting point about foreign investment, and I think when we talked earlier, you were wondering whether this, you know, this antipathy to foreign investment is driven by xenophobia. Looking at our results on immigration, for example, suggests that this is quite a low-order concern for Australians, despite the fact that it gets so much airplay. You know, what's your response to that? Why is this issue of immigration, why has it become so prominent in our public debate? So to the extent that we now have a new political force in Australia again.
Yeah, look, there is a difference between breadth of opinion and depth of opinion. So take asylum seekers. I mean, that is an issue that a very small number of Australians feel extremely strongly about, and it will decide their vote. And I can say that as someone who has an electorate that is either number one or number two in the country.
And very specifically geographically located too, in battleground seats.
Well, increasingly in battleground seats, I suppose. Mm. So there are, you know, there's the classic Western Sydney battleground seat, and we understand that dynamic well. But, you know, my seat is a Green Labor swinging seat, and the same in Batman, Wills, Melbourne Ports. Asylum seekers is a election turning issue in those seats. Immigration more broadly, you know, the one nation factor, there's just no correlation between the number of migrants in an area and a one nation vote. In fact, it's the opposite, if anything. You know, George Christensen, who proudly bragged that he was running on a platform of one nation policies the other day, is 147 out of 150 MPs in terms of the size of his Islamic community. You know, I'm somewhere in the top 15, and I take him to task very regularly, saying, George, if you're concerned, come to my electorate. I've got 5 mosques. I'll introduce you at Friday prayers. They'll ask you a lot of questions about why you're taking away their Medicare. They'll ask you a lot of questions about what you're doing with the pension. They'll probably have a chat to you about the footy, because in the Newport Mosque, everyone is related to Bashar Huli. but the issues that they raise are exactly the same as any other Australian. And the paranoia and the xenophobia, you know, it's a cliche, but it is driven by ignorance. It's driven by a lack of exposure.
Mm. I'm just going to move on briefly, because Holly, you've just come back from Indonesia. Indonesia is one of those really frustrating topics in our annual opinion poll. Every time we ask questions about Indonesia, we get really tricky results. You know, there's a real switch off, and when you talk about Indonesia, there's a, you know, attitudes replete with stereotypes about Indonesians being untrustworthy, Indonesians not cooperating with us on people smuggling, you know, Indonesians not cooperating with us on, you know, whatever that the big problem happens to be. We've had a relationship which has been severely rattled in the last year by the execution of two Australians. What was interesting, though, in this year's poll, which is something that Jim reminded me about when we spoke earlier, was how quickly attitudes have rebounded in Indonesia's favour. Last year, we had one of our lowest results ever when we asked Australians how they felt about Indonesia. This year, it was right back to, in fact, I think our second highest result in 12 years. So within 1 year, how quickly Australians have forgotten. And maybe it's because expectations are mutually low, but we have this sort of persistent lukewarm attitude towards Indonesia, which seems to just reach an equilibrium, just whatever is thrown at it. I was just interested in hearing what, you know, how you feel about the bilateral relationship, is there any way that we can improve relations so that it is not just this bubbling along at this very lukewarm equilibrium, but we actually get some more strength and oomph into it?
So I found it really interesting. I've just come back from the Australia-Indonesia dialogue, and definitely someone who is coming to the Australia-Indonesia relationship quite green, very interested in it from the standpoint of the fact you look at a country that's in our backyard, that's when we talk about the kind of 50% of the world's population under 30, quite often we're not having that conversation in Australia because we're talking about an aging population. But when we think about, like, even thinking to China and market growth and that idea that Australia increasingly needs to think about its own marketplace and region and sphere of influences being beyond the boundaries of just our nation and very much looking to Asia Pac. You know, Indonesia's got 250 million people, 70% of whom are under the age of 40. So there's this enormous demographic dividend that's coming through in that country. It's quite interesting looking at that shift. What I found fascinating as an observer, watching predominantly people who have a deep history in the Australia-Indonesia relationship engage in economic, political conversations across the course of a couple of days, was the tolerance for that conflict that you've talked about. The expectation that the Australia-Indonesia relationship is just going to continually be punctured by periods of high tension, that these issues will routinely happen, and it's almost like we have these spikes, then we work on healing, bringing it back down to a diplomatically palatable level, and then we expect a spike again. So it's interesting to me that there's almost that expectation that is how we operate together. What I also found fascinating was watching our leaders go on the front foot and in advance apologise for what they expect will be a descent in the nature of the conversation that we're having on exactly the issue of multiculturalism and things of that nature. So basically apologising in advance for things that are likely to come out of one nation's mouth and other people within our parliament. So our leaders are almost saying, you're going to hear some things, understand that that's not the broader Australian view. Please take that as the exception as opposed to the rule. So it was quite interesting to see them almost front-ending that conversation as well. I think one of the things that picks up, and Tim called it out on the China piece from my standpoint, the conversations that we were having were very much around how do you remove the fear of the unknown, and how do you really improve that ability to see through conflict by building relationships? Because increasingly we know it's that direct interaction that's making a real difference to how we're seeing in the region. And there's a lot of work that's been done by the Australia-Indonesia Centre and the Australia-Indonesia Institute looking at the perceptions, and it's amazingly stark to look at the difference between young people, for example, young Indonesians that have studied in Australia and their attitudes towards Australians versus those that haven't, and vice versa. And one of the exciting things about what the new Colombo plan's done is it's the number one placement area in terms of the Asian region for young Australians has been Indonesia. So we've seen a real growth actually in young people going the other way. And that's been fantastic for starting to build these really soft power ties between young Australians and young Indonesians. The other focus is very much on how do you increasingly grow that cultural relationship. So a lot of the conversations, and it's interesting because the AusAsia Fest is starting in Adelaide sort of today, an increasing focus on how do you try and use culture as a vehicle for telling a different story, for educating in areas where perhaps part of the tension and lack of understanding or difficulty stems from a lack of exposure or a lack of ability to understand and perhaps have a different lens on why things are the way that they are. So I think soft power tools are increasingly important, and the conversations we were having were really around almost how do you bypass traditional institutions of the bilateral relationship and think about direct engagement. Particularly, we were looking at it from a young entrepreneur's standpoint because we've got increasing growth in, say, the textiles industry and Indonesia, unbelievable when you look at mobile phone penetration rates, extraordinary technological hub. I mean, you look at the period ahead, they'll be G6 by 2030, arguably, and we'll probably switch to G30. So the importance of that opportunity and thinking about how we position for that when arguably we've been pretty flat-footed on China, it's almost the sleeping giant that I think it's really important we think about building relationships with. So from my standpoint, that ability to increasingly facilitate those direct relationships between young entrepreneurs and look at how we create a hive of activity in that way. Obviously, education continuing to be a forefront of our two-way exchange, but I think we can't be complacent about that as well, because increasingly we've got other countries that are looking at building institutions directly in Indonesia and creating more direct relationships because of the strength of the investment dollar coming out of education in that country. So I think it's important we don't become complacent on that piece and we think more about how industry opportunities are going to facilitate a pathway.
Jim's grinning because a fortnight ago I was in Indonesia as well on a youth leadership dialogue of this nature. Exactly the same things come up. But the really striking thing from my perspective is the size of the Indian Australian diaspora is about a fifth of the size of the Chinese Australian diaspora in this country. And that's a function of government policy, frankly. You look at, well, how can we have entrepreneurs having a person-to-person relationship between Australia and Indonesia? Well, it's really difficult when the working holiday visa arrangements between our countries are capped at 1,000. You know, it's less than a fifth of what it is with China. And when, as Holly's saying, the size of the Indonesian economy is forecast to double by 2030, it forecast to become one of the five largest economies in the world in purchasing power parity terms in the next sort of 30 years. This is the next China leaving the station, and we don't have the same people-to-people connections with our nearest northern neighbour as we had with China before. I raise this because last week we were discussing a poll result where 50% of Australians want to ban immigration from Indonesia. 50% of Australians want to ban Muslim immigration to Australia. That's a problem. That's a real problem.
Now, today was a very big day in international politics, so I'm going to go straight to the elephant in the room and talk about the Donald. I don't know if anybody saw the debate today. I think it depends on which commentator you read or watch about who won. But it's something that we have to confront, which is what would a Trump presidency actually mean for Australia-US relations, Jim?
Well, I think those poll results are utterly unsurprising. I think that Australians, if you have a situation where 90% of those that you plus that you you poll value the US alliance, and then you see a candidate like Donald Trump come along and effectively and reiterating it again today that NATO allies are not paying their way, that things are going to be different with Japan, etc., etc., and adopting a protectionist mantra, which he was, in my view, very successful in prosecuting again in the early part of today's debate, the moment where he had Hillary Clinton very much on the back foot. I'm not surprised by these results at all. I think Australians have very good reason to be anxious about an isolationist, protectionist president of the United States, even, and perhaps even more so, at a point where its primacy, the US's primacy in the world, is under challenge. And what struck me about the debate overall, I was talking to you about this a little while earlier, that the received wisdom in the shadow of it and the aftermath is that Hillary Clinton won the debate, and I think that's probably quite right. It was like a slugfest of a lower card. They weren't Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. They were the undercard, both of them. But it was a 15-round fight, and Hillary won a points decision in the end. But the Did it change a thing? No, I don't think it did, because the economic debate in this US presidential year is still being controlled by Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton has had to move away from a free trade, pro-globalization point of view, driven not just by Trump, but also by Bernie Sanders. For Australia, I think this is bad news, and I think that this, the implications of this for the elections on the second Tuesday in November, are that whereas a couple of months ago it looked like, well, Hillary Clinton was an unbackable favourite, and it looked quite possible that the Democrats could win back control of the Senate and possibly even the House of Representatives, I think that the indications, my analysis from this debate, and there are two more, so it could change quite rapidly, is that that's now quite unlikely, that both of them in odd ways shored up their base, that is the enthusiasm of that rather narrow section of the American community that supports Donald Trump will go away from this exactly as they felt it. Hillary Clinton has probably done something to shore up the broader Democrat demographic and enthuse them to a degree which may encourage them to come out to vote. It was notable that in her closing remarks, or her closing remarks, that she again made a pitch to voters in the United States to come out to vote. This indicates that this is, according to the Democrat strategists, a problem for her. And so this is the worry that that if even if she does win, and I think she probably will, that the agenda will still largely be in the hands of Trump and those Republicans who have effectively tried to make the United States ungovernable since Newt Gingrich had the speakership of the House of Representatives in Congress in the mid-1990s.
Well, I'm conscious of the time, and we've done a lot of talking up here, so I want to throw it open to the floor and ask for some questions from all of you. There are two roving microphones. Can I ask you to identify yourself so we know who you are, and also to confine yourself to a question and not a long statement, because we want to get as many questions as we can.
I'd like to ask if the younger people had any significant differences, say, in the relationship with China and with America.
Can I jump in there just before I go to the young people? That's a really interesting point, because while it looked like there was a dead heat between the people who said that there was both relationships were equally important, in fact, the population of Australia split right down the middle. 50%, around 50% of Australians under 40 think that the China relationship is more important, compared with 36% of those over 40. And then the result is exactly reversed when you talk about the United States results. Around 50% think the United States is more important, and only around 35% of that older age group think that the relationship with China is more important. So in fact, we've got a divide, which suggests that as this younger cohort grows older, so will their allegiances continue with China, and will we find that China is indeed Australia's best friend in the world, not just in Asia, but in the world? So to the young people.
I suspect that part of the explanation are the people-to-people ties that we were talking about earlier, that they're more likely to be concentrated amongst sort of younger Australians. So if you look at the ways that that Chinese Australians come to this country, students, young professionals, tourists, and vice versa, I think it's far more likely that you'll find a young Australian who studied in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, than older Australians. It's more of a norm. And certainly from my professional career, it's certainly a norm to have that kind of engagement. I should say my wife is a Chinese Australian who I met in a professional services firm, actually at Mallesons. this is kind of the norm these days, I think. So if I had to sort of hazard an explanation, I think that could be part of it. The other part of it, obviously, is that's the world that we've grown up in. Like younger people have grown up in a world where China is economically not predominant, but economically the rising force, and that feels more like the norm.
That was the only thing I was going to add in. I think it's somewhat to what you were talking about earlier, which is it's a pragmatic view. I think as someone who grew up and worked in the mining boom in the West, and sort of the continual conversation was around China's growth, how significant China would be economically, how increasingly significant it would be politically. And I think even though you may not know it in this language, there's this sense of the decline of the unipolar world that the US have been the dominant force within, to be it a bipolar, multipolar, whatever way you want to look at it, certainly a devolution of the power that the United States once had. And I think irrespective of whether you're aware of that within, you know, the geopolitical conversations, you've likely picked that up within the media. The conversation has been talking about Chinese superiority. The conversation has been talking about their growth, their increasing economic weight, and I think increasingly the decline of US influence and ability to be able to, I guess, prosecute their agenda globally as well as domestically. And it's been incredibly frustrated, to Jim's point, by a Congress that can barely pass a bill. So that doesn't surprise me. I think it's quite a pragmatic view of the world.
Another question. Lady at the front here, thank you.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm Danielle Chubb from Deakin University. I have to admit to a particular interest at the moment in this survey data, because I'm doing my own research into mm-hmm. Australian public opinion and foreign policy. And this conversation that this is kind of leading on from what you've just been saying is that I guess what we've found looking at Lowy Institute polling, and there's Australian electoral survey, there's so much data out there at the moment. It's a fantastic time to be doing this research, as you know. And I guess one of the things we've found is that support for the alliance does increase with age. So mm. this seems to, and it'll be interesting to see, as you said, as you continue doing more polls, if this is reflected, that as people get older, they are more likely to support the alliance. So it's more a life cycle effect. But one thing we found that I think is really interesting, and something I don't think we're quite prepared for, and this is what I think you guys were just talking about, is that birthplace is one of these effects that is strong across time and place. So I guess where you're born, so the shifting demographics of Australia, has a strong effect no matter what your age, no matter where you live in Australia, and as you age, on how you view the alliance, how you view different relationships in the region. And I just wonder, if you look at the most recent defence white paper, and if you look at how Australia's, I guess, clinging to the US alliance, and I say this as someone whose children are American citizens, I understand the personal attachment Australians have, but I wonder if we're ready for this shifting demographic that's happening over the next couple of generations in Australia.
Jim? I'd be intrigued for Jim's view, given you've tracked the US and Australia relationship over time. But I think particularly within the context of the fork in the road that we're at the moment, and how dramatically you think a Trump or a Clinton outcome would change that trajectory?
Well, I think it will speed it up, but I think there's also another element to this, is that the people over 40, over 50 and over 60 in particular, are people who have memories of the Cold War, memories of Soviet aspirations for expansionism, the Cultural Revolution in China, and back through their parents at least to World War II. So for them, and for me actually, and that cohort not being a young person anymore, the attachment to the US alliance and to the importance of the United States in the shaping of the modern world is very important. Now, the interesting question will be whether the rise of China changes that, with that cohort that is coming out of their 20s into their 30s and will move into their 40s, as the United States ascendancy inevitably declines. So are we actually at a watershed, where, or will this what I, my nostalgic in some ways attachment to a world that I grew up in, with all its benefits and flaws, will what has been the norm for half a century, because we've been through this before, we went through it from the transition from Britain as the great protector to the United States. So I do think the jury is entirely out, but I think it is absolutely fascinating and will be very interesting to see.
I just came back from Washington, D.C., and talking about exactly this point. And one of the think tankers over there, and one of my counterparts, observed that that chart where we looked at Australian attitudes towards China, where you had those more granular attitudes, on the right-hand side, the positive things were the people, culture and history, and China's economy. Mm-hmm. But on the left-hand side were all about values. And he said on the other side of that equation is that our relationship with the United States is much more about values and common interests and shared ideals, as well as shared history, culture, language. He said it's much thicker, our relationship with the United States, than with China. What happens if China's economy does not progress as strongly as it has in the last decade at 10%, on an average 10% per annum over the last decade? What happens if it slows down? What happens if the relationship is not just about Australia's prosperity? What is there to build on, other than just a youthful openness to dealing with people in China?
Although the current US presidential election campaign suggests that there are risks on the other side of the relationship as well. Yeah. I mean, those values are being tested in the US at the moment. Yeah.
And the last time our relations with the US fell to a low point were at the time towards the end of the George W. Bush presidency. And we asked why that was, and Australians said it was because of George Bush and it was because of US foreign policy. It was nothing to do with the American people or culture. So quite similar responses.
I mean, I should rush to say I'm a young person on the panel, in the cohort there. I'm a cinephile. I've got a very deep relationship with China. We speak Cantonese at my home. But I'm also a member of what is derogatorily referred to in the Labor Party as the Big Mac faction. I'm about as pro-US alliance as you can get. And, that was pretty hard during the Iraq War, saying to people that we have a relationship with this nation, not with this leader. There will be a world after George W. Bush, and our relationship needs to endure into that. And I had enormous glee with some of my colleagues to the left when Barack Obama was elected, saying, you see, this country, it shares our values, it comes out on the right side of history, we need to stay the course with America. They're going through some difficulties at the moment, but, watching Hillary on the stage today, I was enormously reassured. I mean, this is the most qualified, competent candidate for the US presidency in history. But if also she is elected, the alliance will be in very, very, very good hands.
Yeah, and that's just the big if, isn't it? She's also the most distrusted, and I think...
Well, Julia can explain why that is. I mean, that is just... That is just misogyny. As someone who's really, Julia was the electorate next door to mine. Hillary is going through everything that Julia went through in Australia. It's not a reflection on her at all, in my view.
But it's an interesting one for exactly that point you were making earlier about the get out to vote call card, because I think what concerns me, and I spend a lot of my time in the US, is the fact that even if you really, really don't like Trump, as we know there is a huge swathe of Americans who don't, that doesn't mean you turn out and you vote for Hillary. If you're dyed-in-the-wool Republican, that doesn't mean you go and vote for a Democrat. And I think what will be fascinating will be, firstly, voter turnout, but also just the way that plays out, because Trump gets people fired up in big numbers. And the notion that just because Hillary absolutely is the most qualified candidate, arguably, we've ever seen to be president, will naturally mean that she ascends to that role. I think, unfortunately, if Brexit's taught us nothing, is don't underestimate the power of the angry, and the power of the disillusioned, and how dramatically they'll show up to vote. Yeah.
This is an interesting one, though. We talk about the health of our democratic institutions. I always emphasise that part of the problem here is the decline in the media as well. The coverage of the US political debate is, the US election at the moment, doesn't even get to the core of what's going on at the moment. As Holly is saying, this is a get out the vote contest. And we now have some really good science on how to get people to the ballot. And this is data driven. It's A/B tested. It's randomized control trials. Every step of politics now is empirical. It's scientifically driven. So Hillary Clinton has a model not only of who her likely voters are, but who the people who are likely to vote 2 months early are, what the best way of contacting every one of those individuals are. Is it by phone? Is it on the doorstep? They know what bus routes they take. The sophistication of the data modelling and the empirical approach to politics at the moment, she has thousands of people doing this, and there's no media coverage of it.
No.
That's the contest. And the fact that Trump has less than 100 people doing that indicates to me that turnout is not going to be a concern.
There has been some coverage of it, but not nearly enough. I would agree. But what's interesting about that is, despite the fact that the Democrats are a hell of a lot better organised on this front,
absolutely,
and in fact it was that organisation which probably saved Obama in 2012, that they are still worried. They know all this stuff. They know what you had for breakfast and where you're going to have your coffee. But they are still worried about the stillness and stiffness of Hillary's campaign, her inability to enthuse and captivate. that they still think, despite the demographic advantages, mm-hmm. despite the data sophistication that they have, they are still clearly very, very worried about the fact that they may not yet get those voters who are instinctively Clinton supporters, get them to the machine.
Well, that's one thing that hasn't changed, because in politics since time eternal, the only vote you don't worry about are the ones that tell you they're not voting for you. Everyone else you stress about until the results are told.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, we've got time for probably two more questions. A gentleman there with fourth row.
Excuse me.
Joe Foley. Just linking the screen, the number one interest of Australians in education. It's a broad topic, and I don't know what people mean by being interested in education. You hear push now that, you know, two-year-olds, three-year-olds ought to be drummed into school and brought up there. And at the other end, we have five times as many lawyers graduating as there are jobs for them. It's a matter, and then the people come out of school and they're not terribly interested in international affairs and so on. So it's the targeting of the education. Any comments on that?
Look, I think it's intriguing. I think there's something about polling, and I'm not sufficient of a statistician to deal with it, but anecdotally I would say if you look at polling within Australia leading into any election campaign, you will see education and health at the top and the economy maybe third. I don't think that's ever a real hierarchy. I think that in fact there's a phenomenon in the UK called the shy Tory, you know, which is the notion of someone who wants to vote Tory but doesn't want to say so. I think people feel selfish when they think about their own hip pocket, and so there's things within polling that aren't as how they quantify it is not how it comes up in qualitative research. And I think it's interesting that you're saying Australians not interested in international affairs. I think that in fact the way in which in the Lowy poll you've seen shifting attitudes to the United States, to Indonesia, a sudden shift from the Sukumar and Chan live meat boat turnbacks into what we're seeing now indicates a greater degree of engagement with the community, the international community around us, than perhaps the poll would suggest from those raw numbers.
Yes, let's not confuse, foreign policy has been not a particularly high priority, which I think it probably is a mid-order priority, with ignorance. I think that people make the mistake of saying the Australian population doesn't understand about foreign policy, doesn't understand the nuances. Why would you ask a question about the alliances? Why would you ask a question about submarines or freedom of navigation operations, which we asked a question about this year and found that Australians have very unequivocal views about that. 75% of Australians thought that it was a good idea to conduct freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
So they do have, they are sophisticated and they do understand about these issues. So it may be a mid-order concern, and maybe education and health, as you say, there's some inbuilt biases into the very idea of asking that question, because people, like you say, would tend to want to look, you know, philanthropic or benevolent or, you know, whatever it is, rather than worrying just about jobs and the economy. But it's a good question. So one with this lady down the front here, and then you, and then we'll finish. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Eva. I'm here to ask questions on behalf of the future generations of our country. As a poll indicated before, that the youth, there's an apathy towards believing in, you know, democracy and what our governments are doing for the youth. The gentleman touched on before that there's some jobs that by the age of 40 will no longer exist. Mm. There are other instances where we have 30% of unemployed youth. What do we propose, and as yourselves in a position of, you know, power and a bit, to do regarding these very, very important issues regarding our country, our future of our youth? Thank you.
I think Tim should answer that one, being the politician.
Yeah, so just two things from that. You use the word apathy. Like, I push back really strongly on that. What we're seeing is a disengagement from traditional political institutions. Definitely not apathy. Young people are really engaged with political issues. They have very strong views on political issues. They just don't think existing democratic institutions are worth bothering with. So you see there is enormous political engagement and activity from young people through single issue campaign groups, you know, through banning live exports, through asylum seekers, through climate change in particular. It's just that they go through that through non-parliamentary, vote orientated groups. Now, I mean, as a member of a representative democracy, I think that that's misguided, and we've got to make a pitch to people saying, you know what, there can be as much innovation and as much technological change as possible, but we're always going to need a government, and they're always going to have to be a clearinghouse for different views and for, you know, reconciling differences in public opinion. What I do think increasingly would be a useful reform to start bridging that gap is lowering the voting age. I think at the moment, if we could lower the voting age so that young people's first engagement with an actual election happened while they're at school, that would be useful. Because you could have a process at high school where, you know, that first occasion of going to the ballot box happened within a context of citizenship education, all that kind of thing. At the moment, yes, we try to enrol people in classes, although we miss enrol people in school, although we miss an enormous number. But that engagement with that first election can often happen outside of the school environment. So, you know, it's not a silver bullet, but it's one of a range of things I think would be useful.
Can I take one last question for the gentleman at the back there, because we have run out of time, and I did promise to finish on time, just in the back row there.
Yes, good evening. My name is Nick Wilshire, and I've been living in China for 14 years now. I consult to property development and technology companies in China. The question that I have is, because I've done my initial research before coming here, and the perspective and the view that the Chinese see Australia is very different to the way Australia sees China. The Chinese see Australia as being not important, and I suppose a place to go for a holiday.
They're not alone in that. It's most of the world.
Do you think that we can be doing more in understanding what the Chinese people are thinking, and what, you know, we potentially can do as ambassadors visiting the country to potentially help them to get a better understanding of what we're about?
I think you should defer to Holly. I think Holly has got some real-life experience as far as this is concerned, and actually at a very interesting level is engaged in a very substantial project, which I think has, you know, big two-way potential in terms of benefits for Australia.
Appreciate that setup. What Jim's referring to, as a great Port Adelaide fan himself.
No, Hawthorn.
Well, his wife is one of our most avid fans. I'm very grateful
for her. I live in a divided household.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you're subjected to Port Adelaide fans, then, I'll put it that way. But Port Adelaide, the first team to basically pursue taking AFL to China, and actually pushing and will be holding the first ever AFL game outside of Australia next year in Shanghai. So it's a big project for the club, and very much from the strategic standpoint of going, well, as Port Adelaide Football Club, we can't hope to compete with the likes of the Collingwoods of the world and things like that if we get 1% more of South Australians supporting Port Adelaide. We have to think about, how do we take the game to the world, to the nation, but certainly to the world. And it's that piece around, is it easier to shift a died-on Western Bulldogs fan to become a Port Adelaide fan, or to convince someone who's not, or to convince someone who's not an AFL fan to barrack for Port Adelaide, or is it just as easy to go up to another part of the world and introduce them to the sport? And we've been blown away by the appetite for this Aussie rules, for the interest in Australia culturally, and when we kind of very much are taking that viewpoint of it being almost an Australian fair. We've been broadcasting AFL games this year on CCTV for most of our rounds since about round three, getting well in excess of 3, 4, 5 million viewers from China, which makes it the highest broadcast viewership of an AFL game ever, every time we've had it broadcast in China. So it's interesting to see that. And we see sports diplomacy as an enormous tool for that. We're getting not only interest in the sport, but interest in Australian sports science. We're getting interest in the trade relationship, and certainly a lot of the hospitality and tourism side. So we hope to be at the forefront of that two-way relationship and starting to broker a new way of the two countries engaging, because we know part of the strength of the Australia-India relationship is cricket. it's built around this sport and this incredible rivalry and opportunity we have. Now, we're not saying that we'll necessarily get football to that level, but you think about taking even a fraction of the Chinese market with sports diplomacy and the opportunity to present, and it's absolutely enormous. So it is a really exciting time. I think in answer to your question, yes, could we be doing more? Absolutely. And part of what I think I certainly look at with the Australia-China relationship and why I'm excited by what Port Adelaide's doing here is because we've talked about this relationship for forever. And yet you look at the data around Australian businesses that have an operating presence in China, and it still sits around, as you would be well aware, 8 to 10%. As Jim called out before, you know, this relationship's viewed as important and they're our best friend in Asia, but look at our response to foreign direct investment. And we hear that from the Chinese business people we're dealing with all the time at Port Adelaide going, do you want us or not? You know, because there's these mixed messages that are going back to people who are saying, well, isn't that what engaging and operating and us playing a more significant role in one another's economies, isn't that what it looks like? Isn't it direct investment? So I think definitely opportunities to improve the relationship, definitely opportunities to strengthen the ties. And I guess our view from a Port Adelaide perspective would be that how do you look at soft power and how do you look at opportunities like sport to be almost the gateway into far broader cultural, business, political conversations rather than just probably the direct bilateral channels and the direct big business engagement that's the extent probably of the relationship at this point.
So there we go. We did end up with the football and sport diplomacy. Well done, Holly. Thank you very much to my three panellists, to Tim, Holly and Jim. I'm sure they had far nicer things to do on a Tuesday night than come along and share their time with us. But I really appreciate having the three of you here. So if you could please join me in thanking them very much for their time.
And Alex, if I could just say one thing too. This is an incredibly valuable exercise that 100%. You do here. And the Lowy Institute should be congratulated for initiating it, and not only that, persisting with it, because the longer run it is, the more valuable it will be. So thank you.
Thank you.